My topic this morning is the ABCs of eating out, what to ask about restaurants, about food places. Depending on the time that I have for the presentation, sometimes I include Shabbos issues as well. I don't think I'm going to have time for that today, but maybe a different time. Jewish people love to eat. The problem we have is we've become too comfortable and too expecting of what's available. If one stops to think, the frum community, or the Jewish community, however you define those numbers, makes up less than 1% of the population of the United States. Of that 1%, how many of them are frum Jews? If we stop to look and see why companies as big as Coca-Cola and the like are putting an OU on their product, is nothing short of a modern-day miracle. Baruch Hashem, a lot of programming takes place through the OU because of these companies that have decided. But the concept that that everything should and can be kosher is far from it. I'm going to try and give you some perspective, as some issues to look for, try and share with you some questions to ask when you find yourselves in different places and you're not familiar with the standards of the local hechsher that's going on, and try and be an educated consumer when we come out of the conversation. The other option is what most people do, is just text me, but that's a separate conversation. So we start with the ABCs of eating out, which refers to a number of different places. I know Rabbi Gersten already spoke about coffee. We'll speak about mostly about restaurants, but restaurants can translate into an ice cream store, can translate into a restaurant, Milchik or Fleishik. I guess we can't talk about Fleishik now, it's the 9 days, but we'll pepper it in somehow. And any other variety, when you find yourself going to a simcha in a treif, a place, what's going on? What are some of the concerns? The first, can someone help? Anyone have the technical ability to elevate it a little or pull the table back a little? No, pull that table. No, I don't think you need to do that the whole time now. Come on. Is the tissue box is too high? No, it's not the laptop. It's not the laptop. It's the projector. It cannot be pulled back. I think that's table. The table back. Pull the two tables back. Yeah. Right, but she's.
She's saying raise.
You have to raise this, but it's not.
Is there a way to raise that?
One second. Cool.
You have to put something underneath here, right here.
There we go. That's fine. Fine. One of the first issues one has to look for is the concern of Bishul Akum. Right, food cooked by a non-Jew. Chazal saw a concern of that food is one area where people come together and will bring to Kiruv Levavos. If you look at any Kiruv organization, what they're trying to do, their easiest way towards the heart of a Jew is through their stomach. Right, so if you go a step further, the interaction between Jews and non-Jews, Chazal created many decrees. One of Bishul Akum, food cooked by a non-Jew. Some of the considerations one has to look at are, first, is the food edible raw? Right, so if you have an apple, pepper, corn, hearts of palm, right, are all edible raw? So there would be, Chazal did not make a concern that that's not considered an important food that someone's going to, even if that person cooks for you, you can eat it raw. So they haven't done anything to enhance the food. As opposed to something that's not eaten raw. Right? Eggs. A simple example by a bris. Right? You don't see anyone turning on the fire by the bris and they're cooking eggs. That's Bishul Akum. Right? You have to have, by a bris, someone who's a Jew who's monitoring the fire, and if the shul in the social hall has a powerful air conditioning right by, and the vent right over the propane burners that they're using to make the eggs, one has to be constantly vigilant and watching to be sure that it doesn't constantly go out each time they're making eggs. Right, potatoes, right, meat, right, raw meat. None of us are running to eat raw meat. And then we have the controversial topic of fish because of sushi. But sushi is eaten, usually the smoked salmon, but there's many of the fish is eaten with rice that's already cooked, and we'll talk about rice in a minute. But for the most part, fish is not eaten raw. Right? So those are issues that will come up. A second factor in the, right, is, I thank my kids for doing this. I don't have to do any of that. All right, the second condition is that it's something that's going to be eaten at a state dinner. So potato chips, cornflakes, canned beans, and cheese, which is also something that's, the milk was already cooked, right, is not going to be served at a steak dinner. And therefore, even if you find, right, something that's either edible raw or it's not served at a steak dinner, will not have a concern of Bishul Akum. That doesn't mean that canned beans that are made on equipment that's that they're cooking pork and beans at the same time, right? You need a hechsher to be sure, but it's not going to be an issue of Bishul Akum. Right, correct. Right, but for example, items that are olal shulchan melachim, right? Your meat, your eggs, your canned potatoes, and then you have your rice, which is your second ingredient in sushi. So we can dispel the notion very quickly that someone can go to a sushi bar that doesn't have a hechsher and eat because your two main ingredients in your sushi have a problem with bishul akum, the rice and the fish. Right, so you have to be careful to make this assumption that you can just go to a sushi place and not have an issue. But it's also relevant, not only the food cooked, but who's turning on the fire, right? Whether you have a chef, whether you have a pilot light. I think it was President Reagan who got rid of pilot lights in all of our domestic ovens, right? When you have an energy crisis, so they didn't want the pilot lights to be staying lit all the time. So that created a major issue for Bishul Akum. That's where the electronic ignition ovens come from. But the electronic ignition, every time it's turned on, right, it has to be turned on by a Jew. And that's where this is relevant in many people's homes where they have someone who's helping them. Right, the non-Jewish staff is not allowed to be cooking, whether it's in the restaurant or in your house. Right, who's turning on the fire? Right, the next issue that one has to be aware of is the segregation of meat and fish. Right, our first example, if someone wants to help me, I can't pronounce the name of the sauce. Thank you. That's not my, I don't know how to pronounce it. There are too many shers and s's and t's. I don't know what's going on with that. But the bottom line with this sauce is that there's fish that is put into the sauce in order to be called this type of sauce, even though some people don't. But there's fish in it. Some of them are going to be labeled OU fish, and some of them are going to be labeled OU parv. What's the difference? So the OU's taken a position that if the amount of fish in the sauce is less than 1/60th of the sauce, then it can still be labeled parv, because the sakana, the danger of eating meat and fish together, is not there when it's in such a minute amount. Right? So in an OU restaurant, we won't let them have one of these sauces that has an OU fish on it, because it can just as easily be used for fish as it can be used for meat. So it's one of those type of things. And this is an important point. A restaurant or a caterer will always ask a question: Rabbi, is this halacha or is this policy? Right? Sometimes policy sometimes will trump halacha, because it has to be a system that can work within a place. If they're going to have that sauce in the kitchen, and it's going to be just as easily poured onto the to the chicken or onto the meat that it's going to be poured onto the fish, it's not a situation that is controllable even with a mashgiach in the kitchen, and certainly when there's no mashgiach in the kitchen. So even though the OU will give a hefsher, right, it's going to have an OU fish, and there are going to be certain other items that will have a hefsher, we won't necessarily allow a fleishig restaurant to use it in the restaurant. Right, can the sauce go on meat? Next question. Rabbi, I went into this restaurant. It's a fleishig restaurant, and I only bought French fries. Do I have to wait 6 hours? Right? Fish and meat together. That's the first question. Do I have to wait 6 hours? And the second question, if the French fries are fried in the same oil that they're frying the chicken fingers, can those French fries be served with fish? Then one of my favorite questions, which we may be repulsed by, but it comes up all the time. Rabbi, someone just came into the restaurant and wants to order a tuna pastrami sandwich. While we may not be so interested in eating it, right? For other people, that might be a delicacy. Right? The halacha is you can't serve meat and fish together. What we tell the restaurant is, even if that would be put on a plate together, it would not do anything to the kashrus of the plate. We're not allowed to eat it. So we tell the people, a person's allowed to order a plate of tuna and a pastrami sandwich, or a pastrami or a tuna sandwich and pastrami on the side, but not on the same plate. That would not be a problem. And finally, at a wedding, what utensils are they served with? Anyone who's been to a simcha knows that at the fancier simchas, they serve the food with what they call French serving. French serving means they take the little tongs and they take the meat and put it on your plate, and then they put the potatoes, they put it on your plate, and then they put the green beans and put it on your plate. All right, what happens if they're the same tongs they're using for the meat, they're using for the potatoes and the green beans, they can't serve the fish on the same plate with the same time that they're serving the side dishes. That's why what you'll notice is if someone's ordering the fish alternative, they're going to come from the kitchen with the fish on a plate, because they have a separate section in that kitchen where they're going ahead and they're plating the fish and the green beans and the potatoes with separate tongs and separate knives, separate serving, to be sure that the meat and fish are not mixed. So this is something that's relevant, whether it's in a restaurant, whether it's at a catering event.
Excuse me, you didn't answer the question about waiting 6 hours after the French fries.
All right, so it's Machokas Haposkim. Many say that you have to wait 6 hours after the... The next concern that we have is, and it's relevant in different concepts, the concept is referred to as basar shenas alam min ha'ayin, colloquially, that meat that has disappeared from the eye. It's also a subcategory of what's called shiluach al yedei akum. Anyone who's ever sat in their office and ordered lunch from the, or ordered food from any restaurant, and they come and the food comes to the restaurant and the food is not sealed, what do you do now? Right, the halacha is that we're concerned that the person who's delivering it, if it's delivered by a non-Jew, might have switched your pizza for some other pizza, or they might have switched your burger for a McDonald's burger, and you know the difference in price between a burger from a non-kosher restaurant to a kosher restaurant is significant, and they can save the money on giving the burgers to two different people and making a few extra dollars. So we have deal it from the kashrus side on how we seal the refrigerators with meat, poultry, fish, or cheese, right? A display case. You walk into your local takeout store who's selling, who has all their deli and all their other things, and at night they have to either lock up this display case or take all of the meat and fish and poultry or whatever's in there, put it in a refrigerator. It's going to be locked because we want to be sure that we know what's in there is supposed to be there. And then, of course, our favorite is the food that comes to you that's sealed, that you want to be sure that it's properly sealed. So the halacha says that by meat, you need either two seals or what's called a siman muvak, right? The halacha considers that the kosher tape that's really properly sealed to be a siman muvak, that you don't need the extra protection. But generally, what we try to tell the restaurants to do is to put kosher tape over the bag and staple the receipt over the kosher tape, which is an extra siman, because if they take the receipt off or they try to break the tape, it will certainly break. All right? Protecting the integrity and the kashrus of the food. All right, the next most common question that the kashrus hotline gets, all right, if he gets about 500 questions a week, usually about 250 of them are related to a favorite cookie of everyone's, Oreos. About another 125 of them are, Rabbi, it has an OUD, is this dairy or dairy equipment? And the other 125 are miscellaneous questions. All right, so this is a question of not bar not, which means that the food is made on equipment that's either dairy or meat or vice, etc. Right, double stuffed Oreo. Now, I usually take this test whenever I speak, because there's usually a lot of misinformation, even with those 250 questions that the rabbi gets every week. Right, everyone has a different concept of what the real story is with the Oreos. So I throw it out. Anyone want to venture a guess? No? No one eats. Everyone's makbid on pas yisrael and chol yisrael, so it's not a problem. Okay. Yeah.
Is the question, are they milk?
Correct. Correct. So the regular, the double stuff, the mega, the thins, those that are made with the regular chocolate and the regular cream are made with parv ingredients and dairy equipment. A few months ago, there were a couple others that were added to the list. I don't know them by heart, so I'm not going to throw something out that I don't know. But it's important to know, what does that mean? Right? It means that if you want to have it for dessert at your Shabbos table, or you want to put Oreos on top of your parva ice cream at your dessert after you ate fleishiks, you would be allowed to do that. But you wouldn't be, you know, forgive me if you don't like this concept, but you can't sprinkle it on your chicken. Right? The Haagen-Dazs sorbets happen to be something that's also, certainly not the cream ones, but the regular sorbets are also made in dairy equipment. And then this is where we come, right? Can these be eaten with meat / dairy? Yeah, okay, thank you. And what about fish? Right, can you eat your French fries that are made in meat equipment? Can you eat them with fish? The next issue, the Shulchan Aruch writes that if someone is serving parva milk, right, that one is supposed to put the container, the Shulchan Aruch uses the example of almond milk, chalav shkedim, right, that if they're serving, you know, the parva milk, they should actually put some almonds next to the milk, that one should know exactly what it is. So this manifests itself in a number of different ways. For our caterers, especially when they're going into a treifa place, you know, and you can imagine you're at these fancy dinners, and they're serving everything with white towels, and everything is on the up and up. Then you come to the creamer, and the creamer is in the portion controlled size creamer. The reason for that is the difference between creamer and milk, you know, to the naked eye is not a big difference. Even though one of our mashkichin told me if you pour a citrus fruit into the milk and it curdles, you know it's real milk, and if not, it's dairy creamer, non-dairy creamer. But we insist that it has the actual container on it, so you see what it is. You know, the caterer is going to want to pour it from a creamer. We tell them, no, put on the table the non-dairy creamer. This way, you can see that it's actually parv. And it's important to know, because some of the coffee mates are labeled non-dairy creamer, but are actually OUD and 100% milchik. There's an ingredient in the non-dairy creamers called sodium caseinate, which is a derivative of lactose, a dairy milk, and many of them have more than a sheer bittel in them, and therefore you have to be very careful that even though, Rabbi, it's non-dairy creamer, what could it be? You know, the dairy farmers have lobbied the USDA to allow them to call this non-dairy because it's not actually coming from milk. Right, the silk soy milk happens to be labeled OUD, but it's also dairy equipment. This is another type of item where we would not let the restaurant have it in stock, because just as much as if you're using it for coffee, first of all, some people drink coffee with their meal, not just after the meal, and second of all, I know in some of the recipes my wife uses for kugels, she uses soy milk. Right, so while you can use it for the coffee after the meal, if you're only having soy milk, right, that's not such an issue. But if it's going in the kugel, we can't serve it with meat. So one has to be careful. And then the almond breeze is actually parv. Right, so just because it says it's non-dairy, you have to be very careful to be sure that it's okay. Right, if served by meat meal, do we require the actual container? Now we've discussed the five issues that we've discussed were the issues of bishul akum, right, food cooked by a non-Jew, basar shenasalu min ayin, right, the sealing of the food, meat and fish, right, dairy and non-dairy, dairy equipment, and we spoke about the parva milk. Now you want to see how these manifest themselves in conversations related to restaurants and related to catering events. And some additional questions, right? We call it what to ask about a restaurant and sound intelligent. So I want to present a scenario just for emphasis to prove a point that's very important. When you hear an answer to a question, you know, and you're not educated about what's going on, you can be horrified by the answer. But if you hear a more full question, then you can understand the perspective. So if I said to you that Reuven's restaurant, I don't want to say any names, to Reuven's restaurant, Juan, Miguel, and Carlos have the key to the restaurant. Right? So with just that piece of information, you might be horrified to say, I'm never eating in Reuven's restaurant, because if they have a key, who knows what's going on? Right? So who has a key to the restaurant? Then the next question is, who has a key to the guests? But if I tell you now that Juan, Miguel, and Carlos have a key to the restaurant, but only Reuven or Reuven's mashgiach has a key to the guests, and they can't cook anything in the restaurant if he's not there, right? The question is not as horrific as you might have thought initially. And certainly, if only the mashgiach and the owner have a key to the refrigerators, it may not be as bad as you originally thought. Right, so if I just tell you, Juan, Miguel, and Carlos have a key to the restaurant, right? You might say, I'm never going to this restaurant. You have to hear a full picture to understand what's going on. So you want to ask about a restaurant. So, you ask who has the keys to the restaurant, and they tell you, non-Jews, you say, you can't just accept that to be a problem. You say, but who has the keys to the guest? Who locks the gas? Who turns on the, who locks the refrigerators? Who has the keys? Right, so you have to know a perspective. And one of the areas that people don't really think about that are very relevant, at least for the restaurants that choose to keep their places clean, I put that in quotes. When you're busy during the course of the day, you can't really clean the restaurant. So what's going to happen is, whether it's early morning or late night, they're going to have a cleaning crew. Sometimes the cleaning crew are workers in the restaurant, and sometimes there's a crew that comes 20 minutes, a half hour before the restaurant closes, and they're locked in the restaurant overnight, and they're not supposed to finish until the people come back in the morning. All right, so you need to know that if the gas is not locked or the refrigerators aren't locked, it's happened before that a situation where one of the workers went out to a local establishment and got himself a couple of hamburgers, put the hamburgers on the grill, and had a nice, delicious late night snack while no one was the wiser. So you have to be careful when this is going on. All right, so who's watching the cleaning crew? Right. In 2 weeks, Rabbi Fuchs is going to speak about the procedure of checking vegetables. But you have to know: is there a procedure going on for checking vegetables, or does the local vod not have any procedures in place? Right. What is the procedure for monitoring the fires in the ovens? Right. The pilot lights, convection ovens, the stovetops. Is someone actually monitoring the fires? And often there's a question. Do you need a mashgiach in the restaurant, not a mashgiach in the restaurant? And I'm not coming to discuss any different hechsherim one with the other. OU requires a mashgiach in all of our food service places. But one of the reasons that you need a mashgiach in the place is because someone has to be monitoring the fires. Although there might be pilot lights working and you may even be relying on the pilot lights, spillages and other activities during the course of a day can lead the pilot lights to go out. If the pilot light is now lit by a non-Jew, then all the fires that are being cooked the rest of the day are coming from the non-Jew's fire. So one has to be aware, what's the procedure? Whether they have a full-fledged mashgiach, or they have someone who they'll call a neman kashrus, someone who's reliable to take care of kashrus, and that's one of his jobs, or her jobs, in the restaurant. Next. How should I expect my delivery to arrive? I remember years ago, I think it may have even been here, I interviewed for... someone asked me, what do you do when you get a phone call at 11 o'clock at night from a person with a question? And it's very late. So my first answer was that I do what my father taught me. Someone calls the rabbi late at night. He said, Rabbi, did I wake you? He said, no, I had to answer the phone. Right. But on a more serious note, I said to the person, put yourself in a scenario where your wife went out of town for the week and left you some TV dinners to put in the microwave when you come home, and you see this TV dinner with a hechsher that you never saw before, and now it's 10 o'clock at night, you left the house at 7 in the morning, it's the first thing you're eating all day, and you don't know what to do. Right, you get such a phone call. If you tell the person, why are you calling me so late, right, it's not exactly the answer they want to hear. But the question is, how is the food supposed to arrive when it comes? right? Is it it's supposed to be sealed, and if it's not sealed, so the Shulchan Aruch writes that b'di'eved, if there's no chash chiluf, right? That you know, you called restaurant X at 6 o'clock for them to deliver you dinner, and it came at 6:30. You ordered a burger and French fries and a drink. A burger and French fries and a drink came. There's a receipt from the place. You know, they knew how to charge your credit card very well. Right? There's a receipt from the place, but it wasn't sealed. Right? So these are the type of things to ask. You know, when you're ordering, and this is something that happens all the time. In an office setting, you're gonna have six people getting together and ordering lunch from restaurant X. Right? The delivery comes to the front desk of the office where there's non-Jewish personnel. And, you know, the person by the front desk knows, you know, Reuven ordered this and Shimon ordered this and Chana ordered this. And right. So they open the bag and now they come and they see, you know, their corned beef sandwich and their burger and no seal at all. Right. What happened? The restaurant received an order for, you know, they received a full order. They went ahead and they sealed the outside bag. And now the office personnel opened it up and, you know, it's all, the bag is gone, the seal's gone, no one sees it, and nothing is individually sealed. This is an important point that people have to realize. You know, it's not only in the world where the consumer's right. The consumer has the right to ask for what they want. If you're ordering for six different people, you have every right to tell the restaurant, can you please seal every item individually? Right, you want to make sure that you don't have this problem. They didn't do it. You forgot. Now you're in this 10:30 at night situation and nothing is sealed. Right? You have to ask a question. You can't assume that everything's okay. You have to ask, you know, did you get exactly what you ordered? Does it look like what you ordered? Was there a receipt? Are there other things to rely on? But you want to know how the food is supposed to arrive. The next is who's responsible for checking in the kashrus of, for checking in and checking for the kashrus of all products. Now, you know, hopefully you have someone who's responsible for checking in, but there's a challenge that exists within in the utopian world, right? Everything's coming in, the mashgiach, the neman kashrus, someone is checking every delivery, signing every delivery. It's great, but what happens is if they run out of margarine, soy milk, right, all the things we spoke about that are issues with dairy, not dairy, right? So they send someone out to the local store to go get margarine. Right, and they see the OU on the margarine. Yeah, but in the Fleishik restaurant, it says OUD, or even it's a Milchik restaurant, but the Chol of Yisrael, and it says OUD on it. So, you know, the OU policy is unless it says it's Chol of Yisrael, generally OUD means that it's not Chol of Yisrael. Right, so you have to be aware, and I'll tell you, you know, one of the rabbis in my office, so I shared my PowerPoint, and he said, who's packing out the things in the store? Yes, there are people constantly monitoring the shelves, but things are coming in, you know, by the hour, by the minute, in many situations, depending on how busy the place is. The next question is, on what products are they mafresh challah? Now, some people, you ask, you have to do afreshes challah, so you know, yeah, on the challah you bake for Shabbos, you mafresh challah, but any bread, any cakes, even a pourable batter, right, the OU requires that if you're using enough flour, you know, if you're making a sponge cake, you're not getting anywhere close to the amount of flour. But when you're making 1,000 sponge cakes, or, right, so you are using enough flour to be mafresh after the baking, because you can't, you know, a liquid batter, you're not going to be able to. But it's important to know what's being done there. Additionally, right, what is the procedure in the restaurant for segregating meat and fish? Right, did you have a separate grill? I had a story last week. One of the restaurants, you know, during the 9 days, like, this is a question that always comes up, you know, whether a restaurant is allowed to sell meat, not allowed to sell meat. But one of the restaurants, the OU position is we allow them to sell meat provided that they have a 9 days option. So if a person doesn't sell fish all year round, it only has chicken and meat and does not have fish and any other power of arrangement, so we don't allow them to be open. But otherwise, as long as they have some option, right, we allow them to remain. But in the restaurant, they have two char grills for meat and one for fish. The two char grills were taken out of service by the gas company. There was a leak of some sort. Right? And the mashgiach is calling me. Can they, can they split the char grill in half to use half for meat and half for fish? And it's the question that comes up, but it's something to know, right? So what is the process of separating fish and meat? Right? It's not only the fish and the meat, it's also the side dishes that are being served. Sometimes they're going to, many restaurants use a beef stock or a chicken stock of some sort to flavor some of their side dishes, where you wouldn't think that rice or potatoes might be an issue, but sometimes it could be really fleshy and can be a problem serving them with meat. All right. Now, one of my favorite ones. I asked my daughter the other day, why do I have nail polish in my PowerPoint? All right, so, the halacha is, according to the Rama, says that we're required to check eggs. All right, so, in different restaurants have different procedures for checking the eggs. So, often the mashgiach will check it one by one, but sometimes when they're using a greater quantity, we might designate one or two people in the restaurant who are allowed to check eggs. The mashgiach monitors the process and they have what they'll call the incentive program. Give them 2, 3, 4, 5, depending on inflation, give them a bonus for finding a blood spot. So I have my nail polish. You have to be careful that the guy doesn't have any red nail polish in his pocket when he's checking the eggs to pad his pocket. Right, so you have to be careful who's checking the eggs. Right, so these are some of the issues associated with a restaurant. Now, at a wedding in a hotel. Now, I'm going to make an editorial comment, not an OU comment. Just people don't even realize what goes in to making an event in a non-kosher venue. First of all, most of the time, non-kosher is going on simultaneously. Probably about as close as my brother is to my father in the kitchen. Right, there's not much of a distance, and usually, we have to have a mashgiach standing between the two of them, literally, to be sure that there's nothing going on. In addition, and we'll see this as we go, in addition, the staff of who's working at these events is often the staff of the non-kosher venue. You go into a hotel, you go into a club, right? The waiters and the bartenders, everyone belongs to the club, to the place. In addition, the kashrus agency has no relationship at all in most situations. A rare exception might be the Sands and over here in Atlantic Beach. The kashrus agency has no relationship with the hotel because they're being brought in. They're being brought in through the hotel to do the event, and if one of the waiters would actually do something, would go ahead and do something, and you catch them red-handed, it's not so easy to punish the person and make sure that it doesn't happen again. So it's something to think about when you're going to make a simcha. Right, to consider doing it in an all kosher venue. Right, you still have the challenges, and we'll show you some of the challenges. But the challenges are exponential when you're going into a non kosher place. Right, checking all the waiter's equipment. Very often, a waiter has, just as everyone else has in their kitchen, they have their utensil that they like to have. And on top of that, we're talking about in a non kosher venue, the waiters know exactly where the non-kosher stuff is in the course of the day. So you have to really continuously monitor what's going on. In addition, make sure all the knives are from the caterer, especially on the carving station. If you imagine, cutting whatever fancy meat you're cutting, if a certain chef with his knife can get 30 slices out of the meat instead of 25, and you're serving an event for 700-800 people, right, so the caterer is literally saving himself 6 or 7 big roasts by the chef using his knife. Right, that's a real savings to the caterer. You have to be aware, and you have to be careful that he's not holding it inside his white coat. You have to really monitor what's going on. Additionally, who's turning on the fires? We spoke about Bishul Akum. So I had an interesting situation a number of years ago. one of our caterers was doing an event for Bet El. Right, the Bet El dinner has 1,500 plus people at the dinner. So we were having a pre-meeting with the caterer and the mashgiach who was going to be doing the kashering, and the chef turns to the mashgiach and asks him, who's going to be turning on all the sternos, right, the gel fire that's used to heat up the food in these hot boxes over here? Right, so the mashgiach, without batting an eyelash, turns to the chef and says, you are. So, you know, he raised his eyebrows a little bit. And the mashgiach said, everything that's going into these hot boxes is already cooked. It's already cooked. We have a halacha in bishul achar bishul. If it was already cooked, if it's cooked again, it was already cooked by a Jew, it's not an issue. And the mashgiach said, if I turn it on and something doesn't get lit, you're going to blame me. When I don't have to do it, right, you're going to, you do it. And if it's a problem, then it's your fault. But it's something that's important to know that often you have to do what a doctor would call triage. You have to decide whether you wanted to go there or not. When you're doing a dinner for 1,600 people, you may have to do triage. But when you're doing a dinner for 300 people, you might want to make a low plug and say the mashgiach is the only one turning on the fires, because you don't want to have them have a concept that anywhere that they're turning on fires. But you have to be careful, because certain things that are made on, we mentioned eggs before earlier, that if the eggs are being cooked, you know, you can't tell the guy, the non-Jew, to turn on the eggs. Or if they're making crepes or something else that would be a concern of Bishul Akum, right, you can't have the non-Jew turn it on.
Question.
Sure.
If you have a person making omelets,
yeah,
and you don't know who lit it, if you just adjust the flame yourself, does that eliminate the Bishul Akum problem? The flame has to be off and then turn it off.
It would probably have to be off and turn back on, because if it's on a high enough temperature to cook, your turning it up a little would not be enough. All right, what is the procedure for segregating fish and meat? Right, a lot of these things repeat themselves in different scenarios in different ways. All right, make sure all the margarine is parv. Right, this is a major challenge, especially a caterer who does milchiks and fleishiks. Right, you're going to want them to, you know, when they want to make it, you know, they're not going to use these actual things. These just the pictures just help you see the difference between margarine and butter. But they'll be making margarine rosettes and butter patties or whatever they call them. You want to make sure that the caterer does not make the same thing for milchiks and fleishiks. Right, he's going to make it a different shape, a different pattern. This way you can easily tell the difference. Right, who are the waiters or the chefs at the event? Right. These waiters are belonging to the restaurant. He happens to be Jewish. He happens to be not Jewish. But you have to know, if you're dealing with the waiters of the with the chef and with the caterer's regular chef, right? It's very different than if you're dealing with the chef on the of the venue, because the chef of the venue has a lay of the land and knows where he's going and knows what he's doing, and it's important to determine how you're going to administer the event. Right. Who is supplying the alcohol and drinks? This is something that most people are not aware of, and it's a major issue. And I'm going to share with you a story that happened just to emphasize the importance. One of the areas where the non-kosher venue makes a big amount of money off having these kosher events is liquor, and everything is supplied by the venue. Right? The mashgiach spends a lot of time going to the liquor room and making sure that they know, we can't use this, we can't use this. All the wines have to be brand new bottles for reasons that, you know, some places do what they call marrying bottles. Right? They'll take a lesser quality wine and pour it into a better quality bottle in order to make a few extra dollars on that. So you have to be monitoring what's going on. But they know where everything is, right? If you know who is supplying and where it's coming from, you have at least a half a chance of what's going on. This past summer, a year ago, one of our caterers is doing an event. Now this will combine the bottom line with this, and, you know, the bane of the existence, and I apologize if anyone does this for a living here, but the bane of the existence of the kashrus organizations are party planners. Many of the party planners don't have hashgacha, have no hashgacha, are getting things from everywhere and anywhere. And unfortunately, it pains me to say it, but the ones that are Shomer Shabbos are worse than the ones that are not Jewish. because they create an aura of trust in them that is breached on a daily basis. I don't say everyone, but many of them. I'll give you the example that happened. Now, caterer was doing an event in a hotel. The cost of the event of this hotel, of this wedding, was upwards of $1.5 million, without exaggeration. The caterer's part was about $150,000, so he was only a miser of what was going on. The mashgiach went to the liquor room with the head bartender, and they went through everything they're allowed to have, and they had a lot of bottles of Macallans. The OU, we can argue with it at a different time. The OU has taken a position that any single malts that are aged in sherry casks, although Rav Moshe writes it's mutter, he writes Baal Nefesh, the OU has taken a position that there are enough of them out there that we don't need to be relying on these as well. So we don't allow them, and we vigilantly try to make sure that they're not used in the restaurants and caterers, etc. Right? They had a large supply of Macallan. He said we can't use these and make sure they don't come out. He said, no problem, we have a rolling bar, right? Which means they're taking all the alcohol out of this room. Nothing's going to, when they have no reason to come back to this room at all. You see everything on here, no problem. Mashgiach checks 3, 4, 5 times during the event on the bar, and he comes and he sees that, one of the bartenders is reaching under to give the person something to drink. And he just, stands there watching for a minute. He sees it reaching again underneath. He says, can you show me that? They had 12 bars at this event. On every single bar, they put on the party planner, forced them to take back the Macallan because she wanted to have it, and that was what was going to be. We made a federal case about it, and this hotel actually wrote up new protocols for doing kosher events and really worked with us in that issue. But this is something that that comes up on a regular basis, that one has to be very careful and very aware that just because, you're going and the caterer, the caterer and the hashgacha have no relationship with the alcohol, with the hotel, and it's not something that one is going to be able to completely control if you don't have the cooperation on all sides. I'm going to open the floor for a few questions, and then we'll conclude. Yeah.
You have a group of people eating in your office, and you order a big box of food, it's sealed properly, and so on. Go into your office, and you have your receptionist, who's not Jewish, open up the box, unpack everything, and serve it to everybody in the room. Is that okay?
So it should be overseen by a frum person.
Everybody's in the room.
No. What I'm saying is the unpacking, when the delivery comes, a frum person should be seeing that it came, that it was sealed, and be able to be made to testify that that's what came. After that, she can set up, the Jew doesn't have to set up and put it together, but there should be someone who's there and is, popping into the room as it's getting set up to be sure that she didn't go into the kitchen and take a serving spoon, a knife. So I'm saying if someone saw the seal being broken, that's the important part of it.
You don't have to break the seal yourself.
No, you just have to see it being done.
You're on a cruise ship.
Yeah.
And you have kosher double wrap food.
Right.
And instead of you opening up yourself, waiter,
that's a problem.
Stand right next to you.
Right.
Right next to you. They're going to open it up and bring it over to you. You can see everything that they're doing.
Right. So there are two parts to your question. The part of your question of seeing the seal, I'm standing here and you see the waiter where you're sitting, even breaking the seal and then bringing it right to you. That's not an issue. Rav Schechter, his father, not Rav Schechter Shalita, has said that if you're sitting at a table with 5 other goyim, right, that you should be taking that plate with the seal and having it on your plate, on your table, that you should be showing that there's a difference to avoid Maris Ayin in the situation. Any other? Okay, so let's finish with a few. An educated consumer is the best customer. Know some of the questions to ask. Do not be afraid or ashamed to ask. Sometimes people call me and say, Rabbi, I'm apologize for it. Say, no. The more you ask, right, the more people care. Right? If no one calls and asks, so why is it, why should the caterer care if he has Chalav Yisrael, Yashan? If no one asks, no one cares, why should the caterer accommodate? If people ask, they can they're going to be more on their toes. Right, when invited to a simcha, call the caterer and ask the questions before you go. Not you know, when the ice cream is dripping down your chin. And oh, you're the mashgiach. Oh, great. Right, it is our responsibility to be aware of what we are putting into our mouths. Right, if it sounds too good to be true, probably is. Right, we are very fortunate to have available so much kosher food. We need to demand the high standards. And finally, thank you for listening and have a great day. Any different hechsher in one with the other. OU requires a mashgiach in all of our food service places. But one of the reasons that you need a mashgiach in the place is because someone has to be monitoring the